it's Dave. A word about something I wear every time I'm on stage. One golden thread. My wife introduced me to this great line of clothing that fits just about any gig I do. Their shirts breathe, move with me, and stay comfortable whether it's hot, cold, or anywhere in between. I feel like my body and soul are in tune when I wear them. They're made from tree-based fibers, and every piece helps plant a tree. I'm an affiliate, and you can use the code in the show notes for 18% off at onegoldenthread.com. Feel free and gig on. Ready to finish that song that's been living inside you? Check out my 30-Day Power Song Lab. It's a private intensive coaching experience designed to help you write your best song. Apply at davegoodrich.com or see the show notes for more details.
Welcome to 15 Minutes with Dave Goodrich, where music is life. From the beginning, I've always had a deep love for music. I've spent my life creating and perfecting my lifestyle to surround it. My life is an adventure in song and sound, and I'm excited to share what I collect along the way. Join me as we discover new ways to live a richer, more satisfying lifestyle in music. I'm your host, Dave Goodrich. I'm a performing singer, songwriter, producer, and music coach. I want to help you get better at what you do.
Hello, and welcome to 15 Minutes with Dave Goodrich. Today's episode is a special extended conversation with someone I've wanted to sit down with for a long time, Sean Michael Dargan. Sean is one of those musicians who represents something bigger than simply writing songs or playing gigs. He's been a part of building music communities, the real kind, the kind that create belonging, the kind that give artists confidence, the kind where open mics turn into friendships, friendships turn into bands, and bands turn into entire chapters of people's lives. I first met Sean years ago in Fredericksburg, Virginia, near the University of Mary Washington, where he became known not only as a songwriter and performer, but as somebody deeply woven into the connective tissue of a music scene. Over the years, Sean has built a respected career as a songwriter, performer, band leader, collaborator, touring musician, and community builder. His music carries influences from artists like Nick Lowe, Elvis Costello, and Amy Mann. He offers classic college rock and power pop traditions while still sounding unmistakably like himself. He's released multiple albums of original music, continued evolving creatively across decades, and remains actively involved in live performance and music culture in places like Madison, Wisconsin, and beyond. What I've always appreciated about Sean is that he understands the balancing act of music life, the tension between art and survival, creativity and responsibility, ambition and community, individual identity and collaboration. And those conversations matter more than ever. In this episode, we talk about what creates a great music scene and the importance of balance in that community, the architecture of a local music culture, and how musicians sustain creatively over the long haul without losing themselves in the process. We're also going to talk about Sean's newest musical work and collaboration entitled My Half of Forever. The debut single from Dargan Hester is a new project from Sean Michael Dargan and Eric Hester. You will hear echoes of Big Star, REM, The Replacements, and The Cure. Links are in the show notes. I want to thank you, the listener, for being here. Let's get to it. Here's my conversation with Sean Michael Dargan. So Sean Michael Dargan is almost too tall, standing 6 feet, 4 inches, in his favorite black and white saddle shoes. On a good day, he writes and plays pop rock in the vein of Nick Lowe, Elvis Costello, Amy Mann, and the Gin Blossoms. Guitar and voice are his main instruments, but if you're not nice, he'll go get his bagpipes. That's Sean, but there's a whole lot more to that. I know for sure, because I've known about you for years. And again, thank you, Sean, for being on the podcast.
My pleasure, David. Thanks for inviting me.
Welcome. Again, I saw Sean Dargan a couple of weeks ago in Fredericksburg, Virginia, where we first met, and he sounded great. It was just absolutely great. It was a terrific time. So I don't want to go too far into the past. I know you got a lot of things going on right now that are really exciting, but I want to go back just for reference, because there's a really important thing about Fredericksburg, Virginia. I think you might agree with me. I just gotten into town from San Francisco. I'd left there after a stint, basically doing a lot of music stuff over the last decade. And I was a little bit lost, I got to admit, musically. I was kind of finding myself, reinventing myself, and moved to the area, Fredericksburg area. And that's where Sean Michael Dargan comes in. Now, Sean, you were really active and really busy, well-loved in the community. You had this wonderful open mic. You did a lot of really great things, and you were working on your album. I believe it's your first.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk about the framework of basically a community, a music community. Your identity, how much is tied to those Fredericksburg times when you were working hard? And
Fredericksburg, it's just, I landed there to go to college at Mary Washington.
Yeah.
And then quickly discovered, as after I graduated, you know, I'd play music all through college and used supplemental income to help, you know, pay for school.
Yeah.
And found myself playing as well as bartending at a local place called the Irish Brigade,
which really
was the kind of epicenter of our scene back then.
Very cool.
It was a great venue. I met so many great musicians. I used to run the open mic there on Wednesday nights, and then my band would play there probably once a month, if I had to guess, on a weekend. So I was there all the time, and I met so many great musicians and so many great people through the Irish Brigade. Either lived in Fredericksburg or maybe lived in D.C. and came down from that scene, because it's just an hour north. D.C. is, and then Richmond is just an hour south. So we had people come up from Richmond as well, and that's another vibrant music scene.
Sure.
So Fredericksburg was really kind of a perfect location. It was a small city, big town, but surrounded by pretty bigger entities. So we had a lot going on. We had a lot of bands that were traveling through the East Coast that we would get to play. So I had opportunities to open for some pretty cool artists there, and that was super fun. And it was small enough that, as you mentioned, the community played such a great role. We could really meet so many people that were playing music either for a living or just for fun. But because the city was just not so big, it wasn't very daunting. You could really make friends very quickly. There was a great coffee shop right across the street from the Irish Brigade where, we would sit and write songs. And it was just a really, really happening scene back in the very early and mid-90s. And I'm very thankful for my time there. It allowed me to be kind of a big fish in a small pond, which was really, good for my ego on one hand, but also really good for my ability to get my songs out to people pretty quickly and pretty easily, which helped me, develop as a songwriter and as a band leader. And I'm very thankful for that time. And that's when I met you, which was so great.
Yeah, great. Yeah, it was a great place. I had the pleasure of hosting that too. Yeah, I think you scoot out of town, you have something else, because you were a busy guy back there, gigging a lot. And so a couple times that you asked me to host it, and it was a great experience. And I did a few open mics after that, learning how great it is to host something like that. So do you happen to realize how important that open mic is to me?
Oh, that's a great question, David. It's very sweet. It's framed very nicely. You know, I think it's interesting, and you know this as an open mic host. You know, you have one perspective on the open mic, and it's kind of your job. Yeah. You know, you roll in once a week and you set it up, and you try so hard. You know, customer service is such a big element of that. You want everyone, you know, kind of having a bedside manner, because every artist that comes to an open mic is different. You know, some of them are very comfortable. Some of them are pros that are looking to just try out some new song. And some of them have literally never played in front of human beings before in their lives. And so you get the full gamut of people coming to an open mic and having an experience like that. And you want, well, I mean, I can speak for myself only, but I would imagine that most hosts, as I did, want everyone to be very comfortable and to just be feel like they can do their best performance that they're capable of, so they can, you know, transmit their art, their song to the crowd that's there and hungry to hear music. And so, yes, that's the host perspective. But having, you know, a few years before that, before I was a host, I was just going to open mics around DC all the time myself, you know, as a young guy, you know, when I was still in college and then when I first got out of college. And so, yes, having been someone who frequented certain open mics in DC, I know exactly what it means to be, you know, just to show up and play and to be kind of wet behind the ears and really excited. And it feels so important because it is, you know,
it truly is. Let me tell you my story. Why it was so important to me is that I met most of the people that financed my album there. And so I met a bunch of really important players in my career.
That's awesome.
Just at this microphone in this very small community kind of in Fredericksburg, south of Washington, D.C. And I really got to tell you, it's the vibe that you put together there, that sense of community, of wanting everybody to sound good, making them feel welcome, really made it a great vibe. And I think that leads into the entire town, you know, what stands out about that town. And it was a special time, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. For sure. I mean, you know, having graduated from Mary Washington and having many friends who graduated from Mary Washington, some of whom, you know, moved away right away and went to New York or LA or Chicago or wherever to do bigger, you know, to not bigger things, but to do things in bigger places. But there was always a percentage of incredibly cool, incredibly kind people who loved Fredericksburg and felt the draw to stay there. And so I was really fortunate to fall in with that group. And like my friends, John and Kathy, who had gone, Kathy graduated from Mary Wash many years before I had, well, several years before I had. But she had stayed in Fredericksburg, and I ended up living with them in their basement apartment for years. And then other folks that I was roommates with, housemates with, who also were staying in Fredericksburg because it was a really, like you said, a great little city, great big town with a great scene, and just also very strategically located.
Yes,
not just D.C. and Richmond, but then just a couple more miles hours north, and you could be, you know, in other great college towns, all the way up to New York and beyond on the East Coast, and headed south, you know, down to Chapel Hill and Raleigh and those great college towns in the Research Triangle there in North Carolina, and even further south. It was a great place to be based for someone who was touring, which I was doing a ton of back then with my band. And so it was a lovely place to call home, and I would be in Fredericksburg like sort of Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, do my open mic gig, you know, take care of business. And then Thursday, Friday, Saturday, go on the road, you know, an hour or 6 hours or 10 hours away and play some cool shows, and then be able to come back home and live in a great community still.
Yep, absolutely. One thing from the standpoint, I did some booking down there. I had an agency for a little while, and it's really strategic for people coming up and down 95. You get acts coming from, you know, the South. I had a open mic blues night that I did, and I also booked some shows there for a little while. And people would come down from New York, up from, you know, far South, upcoming acts and some major label acts occasionally. It was just
right. It was a great night to do what we call a connector.
Yeah.
You know, where maybe you've got a show in Richmond or down in North Carolina, and then you have a couple days to travel and no shows, and then you've got a gig in D.C. or Baltimore or New York, but mm-hmm. you've got a few days off. Why not play a show in Fredericksburg?
Absolutely.
And it was a great chance to pick that up. And I will say, we can talk about this more, but I have a similar experience where I live now in Madison, Wisconsin.
I was going to get to that a little bit later, too.
Okay, yeah, sure.
With regards to that, because I wanted to lay just a little bit more with Fredericksburg, just to drive home. What makes a music community so great? You know, let's talk about the essence of that. You know, what are some of the things? We've already discussed a couple of them, but what in your mind makes a music scene great?
Well, obviously having a venue, you know, or venues, and we were really lucky. We had, you know, the Brigade was kind of, I would call it like the epicenter, but right across the street from the Brigade, you know, where the Buffalo Room was another great rock room.
Yes.
And it had different names through the years, but that
sure.
it was most loved to me when it was called Where the Buffalo Room. But between those two bars, there was always live music happening 2, 3, 4 nights a week. Mm-hmm. And really, it was a great, you knew you could just go downtown and either turn right or turn left and find a great show. Yeah. But then there were all those, you know, there were other little smaller places. The Grapevine Cafe was a great place to do acoustic music. Mm-hmm. You know, there were the Kenmore Inn, you know, just really, really cool little venues that kind of, I would say we're like satellites around the bigger ones.
Sure.
And the venues are so critical. It's hard to run a venue and do it well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the people that do that, you know, they have my thanks and my undying gratitude for providing me with a place to play. Because you can have all the great musicians in town that you want, and if there's no venue, there's really no opportunity for them to present their art. Well, we really had that. Going back to the Brigade for a second, it was fun. On Wednesday nights, I ran the open mic for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. But on Monday nights, there was a jam that was run by just a local guy, you know, guitar uh-huh. player, songwriter, who happens to be named Keller Williams.
Yes.
Who's now like an enormous, huge star.
Yes.
And he got his start right there on that same stage, just sure. doing an acoustic jam on Monday nights. It was
I used to do those jams with him.
Yeah, I bet.
Keller's great. You know, he's great. I was actually teaching some guitar at a Montessori school, and he had his kid was there, and I was going to teach his kid, but I was on a different plane at that time. But yeah, Keller has done quite well, as have you. You've gone.
Oh, thank you. Well, Keller's in another plane, man. He's in another universe. He is so successful and so beloved by so many. And I appreciate you including me in the same sentence with him. That means a lot.
Absolutely, yeah. He you have toured around the nation, and you've got what, 7 or 8 albums out.
Great. Yeah, I just put out my 8th record last summer, and I'm working on my 9th right now.
That's great. That's terrific. Yeah, I want to talk about it a little bit more later on that, too. So,
yeah.
So I think it's safe to say that Fredericksburg was, I would almost say, a proving ground.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, because that's what it was for me, and perhaps I overdid my stay there. And so, I'm not playing there much anymore. I'm located out of Charlottesville. But so I think we've come full circle. I can say that you learned a lot from hosting those open mics.
100%.
Being gracious with other people, providing a cradle, basically a crib for people to kind of grow up musically. I'm infinitely thankful for that. And whoever's out there that's doing those open mics, hosting them or going to them, you're going to get a lot out of it both ways. And you'll find out, you'll learn a lot about yourself as well. So I'm so glad there are people who are doing that.
Absolutely. I think hosting an open mic is definitely high on the list of great accomplishments that I'm proud of. You know, I also ran another one when I got to Madison for a while, and it was different than the Irish Brigade, but no less enriching, you know?
Yeah. Let's get into Madison right now. That's where you're living right now. My mother actually went to the college there.
Really? Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, very cool. So how does that transfer? Do you feel like a lot of your experience in Fredericksburg transferred into Madison? You've been other places in between, but...
Sure. Yeah. I lived in New York City for a while. I think everybody that wants to be a songwriter should live in New York for a while.
Yes.
It was cool, but it wasn't really my scene.
Yeah.
I lived in Dallas, Texas, and then in Austin, Texas for a while.
Great scenes.
And, you know, Austin was great. I loved it, but it wasn't really my scene.
Yeah.
Then I moved to Los Angeles, and I was there for about a little over a year. And, and it was great. I loved L.A. I really do. I still do.
Yeah.
But then I met my wife while I was living in L.A., and she lived in Madison, Wisconsin. And, we got together very quickly. We've been together 25 years. It's awesome. We discovered she moved to L.A. for like 2 weeks. And then we were like, this makes no sense, you know, because she owned a house in Madison and was trying to rent it. And I rented an apartment that was about the size of the desk that I'm sitting at right now in L.A. And we were like, this makes no sense. So we should live in Madison. And I was like, tell me what the scene's like. And so she told me, and I did some research. This was all early internet days, you know, pre-Google. And, I found out not only was Madison its own vibrant scene, it's a city, you know, it's the capital of Wisconsin.
Sure.
It's where the university is. So there's a lot of culture in Madison itself. But also it's like halfway between Chicago and Minneapolis, which are two enormous music scenes.
Absolutely.
And so in some ways it was sort of served what the purpose that Fredericksburg did, being like a stopover in between touring acts that would be going between Chicago and Minneapolis or vice versa. And it turned out to be especially vibrant because of that. And so I could do the same thing. I could, you know, travel up the road to Minnesota and play in the Twin Cities, or I could travel down to Illinois and play in Chicago and still, you know, be home the next day.
Yeah, it's terrific. Yeah. One thing I found, I might add to the smaller areas, and Madison's what's the population?
It's about 250,000.
Yeah, it's bigger than Fredericksburg.
It is bigger than Fredericksburg, but it's not huge.
It's not huge, yeah. And so there's room for you to think, to create. One thing, living in San Francisco and Washington, D.C. area, I found myself dealing with what I call psychological pollution. And that's where you've got a lot of people running in a lot of different directions creatively with their own motives, right? And so it's very difficult at times to expand your own thought process, your own creative instincts and so forth.
Sure.
Within me, I feel like I need some solidarity. I'm living on a farm right now, 95 acres outside of Charlottesville, the mountains in the distance, and I'm writing pretty well. You know, Fredericksburg offered that back in those days. It gave me a little chance, and I did some of my best writing there, I believe. I had enough.
Well, you know what? I'm interrupting.
No,
I'm sorry. Exactly what you say, though, to be able to be close enough to D.C.
Yes.
or Richmond when you live in Fredericksburg, to be able to go there for a day or half a day or 3 days and enjoy that energy, but then still be able to go home and only, you know, you get the best of both worlds,
yes,
I think.
Absolutely. So do you feel like the younger musicians out there, and there are a lot of younger musicians that are listening to this podcast, and in fact, this podcast is for helping to develop younger artists and people who are getting into it, whatever age, you know. So do you think that these kind of elements that we're talking about, are they there for this current generation of musicians? Post the internet age?
Sure, that's a great question. We haven't really talked about this at all, and I don't know that I told you when I saw you, but in addition to playing music still, which I still do pretty much, you know, not quite full time, but still a lot, three, four, or five shows a month with my band, occasional solo shows as well. But I also have a straight gig now. I work at the University of Wisconsin here in Madison as the advisor to the music committee.
Wow. Cool.
So there's a group of about 100 students in its biggest, fullest sense that all do get together and meet every week and do all the live booking of the four major venues on the campus.
Cool gig.
And,
cool gig.
Yeah, and so I advise them how to negotiate contracts, how to talk to agents, how to deal with artists, how to put the shows on and run the shows when they come. And we put on, during the school year, we put on two or three shows every week.
Wow.
And then during the summer, we actually have a venue out on the lake called The Terrace. We actually do six shows a week.
Awesome.
It's crazy.
That's great.
And so I help book those shows, help book those artists, but more importantly, I help the students learn how to book those artists and to run the shows. So I am constantly working with the 18 to 21-year-old set. And I am blown away by how smart they are, how capable they are. I mean, they don't know how to do these things because they have never done them, but they are so quick to learn, and they have such great ideas. And also, their taste in music, you know, is incredible. It's very different than mine, just because I'm older. I'm a product of the 80s. You know, I still listen to R.E.M. and the Smiths and the Cure when I listen for fun, because that's what I grew up with, you know. But I've been introduced to so many great new bands through the students, and so as you would not find surprising, a subset of the students that I work with, in addition to being music lovers and band fans, are also musicians in their own right and songwriters and have bands. And so I get a chance to work with these students sort of on the side. It's not really part of my official gig, but I do a lot of it, kind of advising and helping mentor young artists in how to be more successful in the music business, and, you know, how to get better at writing songs, how to get better at booking gigs, how to do all that sort of thing. All the things that I did, I just think of it as paying it forward for these, you know, younger artists. And quite frankly, I mean, they are so much better now at 18, 19, 20 years old than I was when I was their age. And so it's super exciting to watch them and hear the songs that they write and, you know, help them get a gig and watch them bloom on stage. It's so cool.
It is cool. And it sounds like that's another expansion of what you were doing in Fredericksburg.
It really is. It totally is.
From your perspective, what are some of the things that younger artists should prepare themselves for a life in music?
Sure. That's a great question.
It's a big question.
It is a big question. There's so many small, intangible, logistical things to know that are all important, but, you know, you can find them in a book. You can find them, you know, on a podcast or on a website. There's the resources that are available to young artists now
enormous.
Dwarf what we had when we were that age. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no internet. Yep. There was no mobile phone. There was no Google Maps. There was no Facebook and Instagram. You know, we did not have those tools. And it's not to say that it's that much easier now, because now everybody has those tools, which means, you know, there's more chatter. You know, there's more. There's just more data out there, more noise, you know, to try to find the signal inside of. But it was, you know, it was a challenge to book gigs and to be successful as a touring artist back in the day, just like it is now. You know, it's just a different set of tools that they have available. But what I would say, one of the things that I feel is the most important to share with young artists that I'll share with you and your listeners now, is zoom out, let's go up to 20,000 feet, 30,000 feet, and look at this big picture that you're considering as an artist. Like, what does it mean to be an artist? What does it mean to be a songwriter and a musician, you know, in the modern era? I think one of the best pieces of advice that was ever given to me when I was 20 years old was something a friend of mine, Arndt Viken from D.C., having lunch at the Bar J Chili Parlor up in Woodbridge, Virginia.
I played there, yeah.
I used to play. I know you did. I used to play there all the time. He wrote this on the back of a menu that I then ripped up and stole because it was the most incredible piece of wisdom that anyone had given me at that point. And now looking back, I mean, I was 20, I'm 58, or I'll be 58 in a couple months. So it's been a lifetime or more, you know, since I got that advice, and it's still the most important piece of advice I've ever received. And it was this in a nutshell, and I will paraphrase because it was a little bit long, but basically, if you want a life in art, if you want to be an artist, unless you seek it as a man whose hair is on fire seeks a pond, don't pursue it. It's too much. Yeah. But if you want it, the gods will give it to you, and you just need to be prepared to ride it on the full rush of power, like Dionysus riding the leopard, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you have to embrace all of it because it only comes the way it comes, you know. And but that whole the concept of a man whose hair is on fire seeking a pond.
Sure.
My friends and I used to bandy that about through the years, you know, and always check in and make sure that our hair was still on fire because I mean, just speaking empirically as someone who went to college and has a 4-year degree, you know, and something to quote unquote fall back on, you know, when I talk to my students here at the university who are in a band and are writing songs and want to do music for a living, I tell them like I would never recommend it to anyone. Yeah. It's so hard.
Yes.
But if the universe is calling you and you need to listen to the call, if it's the thing that you, if you really believe that that is what you're put here on this earth to do, then you would be sadly misled to not do it. You've got to do it. But you got to be seeking a pond like your hair's on fire. You have to be riding the leopard with all of its energy. Mm-hmm. It will completely consume you. And that's what you have. You know, you need to put the other, you know, when your friends are all going out to have cocktails on Thursday night and you need to be working on a record or writing or booking, that's the thing you need to do. And you can't be distracted by these other, seductive side quests, or you won't have, you know, the energy to put into it. And that's what you owe it to yourself, just like you owe it to the universe to do it if that's what you were called to do. And just accept the fact that, yeah, it's a hard road, especially in this country. You know, it can be harder. There's some other, like my friends in Canada, you know, it's a little bit easier to get a grant to be an artist up there. It's a little bit easier. I know I have friends in England, and it's the same thing. You know, our country makes it a little bit harder sometimes to get that sort of artistic, monetary reward for being an artist.
Yeah.
So you got to do it. You got to be all in.
There has to be absolute certainty in your authentic identity as a musician.
Absolutely.
You have to take the knocks. You have to take the joy and also the success with groundedness. You know, I did another podcast about, the 27, 28-year-old syndrome, the Kurt Cobain,
right,
and the Janis Joplins. And
right.
You need to prepare for success as well.
Sure.
It's easy to get lost in that race of going so fast, things coming at you so quickly. And I experienced this too in Washington, D.C. with Mind's Eye around 27, 28. I was the youngest guy. And when things get good, they get good quick.
Right. And if you're not ready for it, it can take you by surprise.
Exactly. And you can overload. You can absolutely overload. And I think a lot of people have a tendency to numb in that situation. So
sure.
there's that realm outside of not only preparing yourself as a musician, you know, with the discipline and your intense certainty in that that's who you are, that's where you need to be. You need to also prepare beyond that. You start booking gigs heavily, start rolling throughout the country, throughout the world. What do you do? How do you deal with your interactions with people? How do you shut down? How do you reset? You know, all these things are so important to keep alive.
Right. You got to stay grounded as a human being, for sure.
Absolutely.
Even while you're pursuing, you know, this life as an artist, which is somewhere up here, you know. Mm-hmm. You got to stay grounded as a human being down
Absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely. And that brings to another part of your life and your identity. And I know you're a father, and you spoke a little bit about your wife. And so how did becoming a parent affect your creativity?
Oh, it changes everything, you know? It ruins aspects of it, you know, to be honest. Like, you're boundless. Time and energy that you have when you don't have children is quickly eaten up. You know, every second, every waking second of the day. I was actually the stay-at-home parent because my wife had a great straight gig in public radio.
Oh, awesome.
And so I got to be the stay-at-home dad, which was amazing. I loved it. And I still did music, but I radically cut back on it. And I just, you know, because those little critters require your attention, you know, and they're demanding, and you owe it to them because you brought them into the world to do everything for them. The good news is they also provide an incredible wash of creativity and inspiration. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I you know, people laugh and call it dad rock, but I wrote a ton of music. I was exhausted while I was doing it because I, you know, was up with the kids at all hours, but I wrote great songs inspired by my children. Mm-hmm. So it's a trade-off. It's the job is dangerous, and you know that when you take it, you know. But
so it's safe to say that your relationship with music changed a little bit. Was it more intensified?
Well, one thing's for sure, because I had less time to work on my art, I was very respectful of the fact the time I did have, I needed to really focus and be just very, very, just very focused, very specifically focused about what I was doing. Like, if there was an album project that I was working on, mm-hmm. I needed to be an even better project manager about that album, so that I knew when I was writing, when I had an hour, you know, which was like a gift from heaven, you know, you take that hour and you make the most of it.
You know, absolutely.
If you're in the studio recording, you do the same thing. You get you work on getting your tracks as quickly and as adroitly as possible, because you know that you don't have
that's
all day.
Right. That's, I think that's a maturity that comes about with anything that you do as a parent. That's what you have to do. It's like you've got these little creatures there that are dependent on you. You've got a life in music you're dependent on as your identity, because if you truly know who you are, as you said, if your hair is on fire, you can't dampen it, you know, and
that's so true. And it really puts a point on it. Yeah. You know, it gives you, in some ways, the kind of focus that you need to continue to move. I love what you say about the art. You know, you're drawing your inspiration and your sense of self purpose in some ways from the art that you strive to make. And then you've got these responsibilities that are outside of the art. Yeah. And so to find a balance.
Yes.
Between the two, or more than two, there's lots of factors. You're balancing all sorts of things, but but specifically between being a father and being an artist is a tremendous balancing act.
It really is. But I have to say one thing. I've coached a lot of adults that have children that are trying to make that balance. I always lean towards making sure that you are fulfilled in your music. If you aren't, that transfers to your relationship with your child.
Oh, for sure.
Some can become resentful.
Resentful, for sure, yeah. Well, then, you know, there's that great analogy, Dave, of when you're in an airplane, they always say, you know, should there be a drop in cabin pressure, oxygen mask will drop, you know, will appear. Put your mask on first.
Absolutely.
And then you can help all the people you, as opposed to being, you know, trying to help the others first. Like, it just doesn't work that way. And you really need to, I love that metaphor of putting your mask on first so you can be more helpful.
Absolutely. So let's move towards what you're doing right now. You've got a duo. You just released a single.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. How did that come about?
Sure. Well, you know, this single that we just dropped is co-written and co-produced and co-sung with, you know, played and sung with one of my oldest friends in Madison, a fellow named Eric Hester, and he's a terrific songwriter in his own right, and he's got his own career, just like I do, and we've been friends for almost 25 years, and we did some writing. We were kind of in a little joke punk band, kind of old nerdy punk band, even 25 years ago when we were, you know, young old guys, as opposed to now when we're like legitimately old guys. But so we wrote together a while ago and it was great. But then we kind of, you know, that band, like all bands, had a lifespan and then it stopped the way bands do. And we, you know, kept doing our own separate things. And, you know, I'm still working. I still make records, write songs all by myself and play with my band and that's super important to me. That's my primary focus. But a couple years ago, Eric reached out to me and said, hey, man, we should write together again. Eric is a huge proponent of co-writing. And although I find great value in it, I just don't do it very often. Not because I'm, again, opposed to it. It just hasn't happened for me. My experience has been very different than Eric's. But Eric said, you know, I really think we should co-write. I think it could be really great. So I was like, sure. So we did. And I will tell you, like, as I'm sure you know from your co-writing experience through the years, co-writing can be a very lovely thing, but it's very hard work. And it doesn't always bear fruit right away, you know, because there's a compromise involved. You know, it's a dance back and forth between two or sometimes more people, but in our situation, two people. And so Eric and I kind of went into this co-writing situation thinking, you know, maybe we'll spend 3-4 hours together and come up with, you know, part of a song or maybe a whole song if we're lucky. And, you know, and we'll see how it goes from there. We got together and we spent 1 hour and we wrote a completely polished, completely incredible song. And we were both like, what just happened? And it was really, the synergy was, you know, really magical. So we got together again and again and again, and, you know, we ended up writing 12 or 13 songs in really record time. And we're both big fans and proponents of the EP concept, you know, extended play, which is sort of, you know, bigger than a single but smaller than an album. It's kind of a nice, it's more than just bite size. It actually has some substance to it. Yeah, but at the same time, it's not so encompassing.
Yes.
You know, when you're doing a 10, 12, 13 song album,
it can drag out.
It can take forever, you know? And so we thought, you know what, let's look at these songs, see if we can find 5 or 6 of them that really hang together. And we did. So we recorded, you know, we grabbed some musicians that we know. And of course, he and I both play a lot of instruments as well. And we recorded 6 of those songs. And they came together really, really well. We're both singers. We're both guitar players. I also play bass on the record, which is super fun. And then we brought in a couple of ringers from our, you know, friend circle to play drums and keys. And one cat who plays harmonica on one track. And we just ended up with 6 songs that sound really great, and we're really, really excited about it. And we've released the first single from that EP just a couple days ago, and it's called My Half of Forever, and it's just a really solid song, and we're really proud of that.
I've heard pieces of it. It sounds great. I'm anxious to pick it up, and
thank you.
We're going to put that in the show notes.
Oh, right on. That'd be great. Awesome. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to try to move towards wrapping things up here. At what point did you realize bagpipes were part of your musical career?
Oh, well, it's ironic that you phrased it that way. I phrase it that way, too. You know, I add bagpipes as kind of a humorous anecdote at the end of my bio that you read in the beginning of the episode. But the reality of it is I've been playing the guitar since I was about 13 or 14. But I've been playing the bagpipes since I was about 4.
Wow.
So they were my first real instrument.
Awesome.
You know, I started marching with my dad's bagpipe band. He was the bass drummer in this bagpipe band down in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And we actually, he had been in a band down in Panama in the Canal Zone, which is where I was born.
Wow.
And so we move around and we end up in Philadelphia. And I'm like I said, 3 and a half or 4. And my mom made me a little kilt and a little tunic. And I would march along. I had a little set of toy pipes called doodle pipes that were kind of, they were bagpipes, but they were, you know, essentially a toy. Yeah. But you could blow into them and they made a noise. And I would march along with the band, and I would stand next to the pipe major, who's the head of the band, and I would watch him. Mm-hmm. And I apparently, I didn't know it at the time, but of course it's turned out I have a really good ear for music. I learned really quickly by listening. And I would watch the pipe major move his fingers as he was playing the tunes and listen. I'd be immersed in the music because, of course, bagpipes are very loud. And I really learned kind of like the Suzuki style. I just imitated what they were doing. And it kind of gave me a real grounding, a real basic basis upon which to build. And then when we moved to D.C. As a child, I was about 7. I got my first real set of bagpipes. I started taking lessons when I was 7. And I studied with one of the best bagpipers in the world, actually, who just happened to live in D.C.
Wow.
And
cool.
Really, really, really fortunate. So I studied with Paula Glendinning, and her husband, Charlie Glendinning, was one of the best composers, modern composers of bagpipe music. So I was very fortunate. It was very fertile ground that I was planted.
That
in.
Is fortunate.
So then I've been playing all my life.
That because I remember back on St. Patty's Day in the Fredericksburg area, that you would be running all over town. You'd have, 4, 5, 6 gigs, and you'd be making out like a king.
Oh, yeah. I used to joke and call that National Pay the Rent Day. You know, it was, I would do sometimes 15, 20 gigs in a weekend around St. Patrick's Day. And it was very helpful. That club that we've been talking about, the Irish Brigade, obviously, it was a great rock club, but it also had the roots in this great Irish regiment from the Civil War. And so, you know, it was sort of baked in the cake there. They had tricolor Irish flags all over the place. And I would play all day and all night long there on St. Patrick's.
So that brings to one last thing. I want to talk to you about something. I think I was in front of Apple Music. You're across the street. You were really busy gigging and writing and touring and everything. I think you were in your truck. You had a blue van or something like that, I think.
I did have a blue van for a long time.
And I was in front of Apple Music close to Hyperion Espresso, where everybody hung out for coffee and so forth.
Yep.
And you yelled across the street and says, "Dave, why do we do this?" I don't know if you remember that. And so I yelled back to you. I said, "I don't know. I think it's kind of a gift." And so,
wow, that is awesome.
And so I look back. At that point, I was saying, well, we're just kind of giving ourselves away, right?
Right,
but then
right.
As an older musician who's been around for a while, I'm thinking about, well, it's a gift to me. And music is
absolutely
is so important to me. And it's how I met my wife. I've toured around and done some things that help others, I believe. I continue to be a part of a greater community. This podcast itself is going out to about 56 different countries. I am so grateful that people are getting something out of it and that we're here for a greater community, not just in the U.S., but all over the world.
That's awesome.
So I guess what I'm trying to say here is it is a gift, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. It's funny. I mean, who knows what I was dealing with in the moment when I asked you that question out the window of my van. But it's very funny. You know, I can see the scene right there. It's great you mentioned Apple Music. That was really like the hub.
Yes. Mike?
The Irish Brigade was the venue. Yeah. The Hyperion Espresso was the fuel for us to do what we did. But we got all our gear at Apple Music, right? And that's where all the musicians hung out during the day. But I could totally see, you know, I was running late to go to D.C. or, I was leaving town or whatever I was doing. Yeah. And it was like, you know, hustle and bustle of the moment. And, you know, smart ass self that I am, I made the joke to crack out the window. And you replied in full character, just the God's honest truth, man. I love that.
So anyway, I think that's the moral of the thing. And you are a gift, my friend. I really appreciate what you've done, what you continue to do for musicians, not only in the Madison, Wisconsin area, but through your work throughout the country, wherever you are, you seem to bring a light. So tell us where you can get a hold of your music.
Sure. Thank you, David. Thank you so much. My website is the best place to go. It's just SeanMichaelDargan.com, and it's spelled S-E-A-N, the Irish way. And Michael is traditional spelling, and Dargan is D-A-R-G-A-N. Mm-hmm. So SeanMichaelDargan.com will tell you. It'll take you links to my latest record, which you can get on Bandcamp, but you can also stream on Spotify or Apple Music or The Orchard or any of your streaming options. And then there's some videos of my band playing, which is fun. And then there's a link, there's a listing of all my upcoming shows, which, of course, are mostly in Madison, Wisconsin, because that's where I live with my family now. But we are playing in Chicago in a couple months, so that'll be fun.
Cool. Yeah, we'll check it out.
And I got to say, seeing you at my gig, getting a chance to come back to Fredericksburg and play last month was such a gas.
It was
such a treat. And seeing you was a real honor. So thank you for coming.
Oh, it was an honor to be there. And seeing all the folks from that era that we're talking about was just, you know, it was priceless. So once again, thank you so much for doing this, Sean. I hope that you come back to the podcast and give us some more great insight that is so valuable. I'm glad that you're sharing that at Wisconsin and Madison, and wherever you go. So thank you for what you've done.
Love you too, brother. Thank you so much, David.
Thanks for spending this time with me. Until next time, much love and much music. To never miss an episode, click the subscribe button. To sign up for the 15 Minutes with Dave Goodrich newsletter, go to 15minutes.powersongtribe.media. That's 15minutes.powersongtribe.media.
Presented by Powersong Tribe, a songwriting adventure company. Own your song, own your power.